Welcome back to our Intelligent Medicine podcast with Dr. Maya Shetreat Klein. She is an integrative pediatric neurologist. And in part one, we talked about the ways in which the gastrointestinal tract can affect the immune system and thus transmit impulses to the brain and to other parts of the body, causing all kinds of problems that kids experience. There's an epidemic of autism and attention deficit disorder that is raging among our children. And Dr. Shetreat Klein, as a pediatric neurologist, sees many of these kids and seeks to find underlying causes that are treatable with natural, gentle interventions. That's what her practice is all about. As we begin, tell us a little bit about your practice. You're located here in New York City, correct?
That's correct. I'm in New York City, up in Riverdale, and my practice is actually both my office and a urban farm with chickens and bees and all kinds of botanicals and food that I grow behind my office as well.
Really? So it's, yeah. It's almost like you have like a little petting zoo there for the kids?
Well, that must be amazing. No, it is not a petting zoo. Most of the chickens don't particularly like to be pet except for one. But
and the bees certainly don't like to be pet.
Yeah. It's more so that people can see how easy it is to grow your own food and so that I can grow my own food because living in New York City, that is a really special privilege that I take seriously.
Well, that's great. So you really walk the walk. You make a personal commitment towards natural eating. Earlier we talked about problems with the gastrointestinal tract. Let's talk now about, and since we're on the subject of organic food, natural food, what are some of the food no-nos for kids? What are some of the real crazy makers for kids? As there was actually a book by Simitaki was her name, who wrote a book called Crazy Makers. I thought it was a great title because it suggests that some of the things that kids are consuming literally can derange them. So why don't you tell us about that?
The main universal no-nos from my point of view are food chemicals. So things like MSG, which can kind of come under many names, including even natural flavors, artificial flavors, but also hydrolyzed yeast or yeast extract or autolyzed vegetable protein or those kinds of things. That's one that I do not recommend.
It's so pervasive because sometimes, you'll look at a package and say, well, there's no MSG in it, but under it has so many, there's so many weasel words for MSG. There's literally
dozens. Right, because, they figured out ways of calling MSG a lot of things so that people are in the dark. I mean, they want it to be not transparent because most people don't want to actually consume MSG. So, and it's usually found in savory foods. And then the next one is NutraSweet or aspartame, which is another one that can... So glutamate, which is an MSG, monosodium glutamate, and aspartate, which is an aspartame, both are excitatory neurotransmitters, and they actually both can cause or trigger issues with abnormal firing in neurons. And aspartame also has other issues, including in some part of the population, the way they break it down is they turn it partly into formaldehyde, which is toxic and likes to hang out by your DNA and pull off little parts of your DNA, which is not really what you want. And it's very hard to detoxify formaldehyde.
So, as you suspect, and we actually talked to adult psychiatrists who believe that there's an inflammatory component in depression and in anxiety mm-hmm. and psychiatric disorders. Similarly, there may be an inflammatory component in childhood developmental disorders. And what you're saying is these foods are a little bit like putting lighter fluid on the fire.
Exactly. Yes. Other things are food dyes. And artificial colors. And there have been studies, actually, there was a great landmark study in 2007 that looked at children, I think 2 and 3 year olds and 7, 8 year olds, and evaluated with it was a double blind study where they had placebo and were rated by teachers and parents and some of them got chemicals, these kinds of food chemicals, and some of them didn't. And the children who had the preservatives and the dyes were much more likely to be hyperactive.
Hmm. Right. That big study out of England, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Right. So those are some of the main things. And then there's some things that are really lacking in kids' diets. And I remember as a kid, I was a real fusspot. You know, I was a real fussy eater. And I just had a total abhorrence for fish. I probably didn't eat fish until I was about 13 or 14 years old. That's when I began to get a little more daring in my food choices. And I was tough to tackle when I was a kid. I was a bit of a handful. So had I eaten some fish or got some essential fatty acids, you think that might have made life easier for my parents?
Yeah, for sure. I think it would have. I think omega-3s definitely have been shown, and fish consumption has been shown to be very helpful for neurologic function and for inflammation. Of course, the other side of that coin is that, you know, we pollute our oceans, and now we find that there are certain fish like tuna, among many others, that are actually very contaminated with mercury. And I've definitely seen kids, and moms for that matter, because I also sometimes see moms for preconception counseling. I consider that to be preventive medicine for child neurology.
That's really where you want to get going, ideally, because, you know, once the problem has developed, it's like trying to shut the barn door after the horse got out.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be quite that bad, but absolutely the best thing is to never have the problem to begin with. Mm-hmm. And having an educated mom from day one, and dad for that matter. I don't want to leave the dads out because I think they're equally as important. But, you know, you want to have educated parents going into it, knowing about, you know, birth choices, knowing about how to feed a baby and so on and so forth. But I see a lot of people who eat a lot of fish and end up having high mercury levels. So, I think it's really important, more than anything, that we want to really support detoxification. First of all, I do say to avoid tuna for the most part because it is high in mercury.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, and certain other fish, and that's something that, you know, can be looked up on Seafood Watch and other great websites where they really test it and let you know what's going on. But in addition to that, just supporting, you know, you were saying deficiencies. I mean, speaking of deficiencies, how many kids walk into my office and, you know, they're not eating any vegetables whatsoever? Some of them are not even eating fruit. So they're missing out on a lot of fascinating and wonderful phytochemicals that enhance detoxification, not to mention all the nutrients that they would be getting from these fruits and vegetables. And that, you know, they might walk in my office not eating fruit and vegetables, but by the time they leave my practice, those kids are eating fruits and vegetables. And it makes a huge difference. It actually really, you know, it really does make a difference. Your grandma or your mom wasn't just pulling your leg.
So that's a big part of it. What about, you talk about the importance of the gut. What kind of protocol might you suggest for, say, the child who has, you know, I got a tummy ache, you know, I'm gassy, bloated, and constipated. You know, how might you break that vicious cycle of the wrong bacteria and the leaky gut and toxic signals coming from the GI tract?
Well, one of the big things can actually be eating organic foods more than, you know, conventionally grown foods, because it turns out that pesticides actually seem to have a really significant impact on the gut, and we're learning a lot more about that. But in addition to that, I recommend that kids eat fermented foods. And at first, you know, parents kind of like grimace, well, my kid isn't going to want to have, let's say, sauerkraut, or they're not going to want to have, you know, kefir or kombucha or things like that. But it turns out that kids really can surprise you. Mm-hmm. And it also just takes being tenacious sometimes. So
so you actually prefer those natural sources as opposed to probiotic pills. You're not averse to the probiotics, but you think the natural sources might actually have more live bacteria.
I think that... we never do as good a job as nature. So while I definitely prescribe probiotics, and especially in the kids who are very significantly affected, I for sure use probiotics as one of the tools in my toolkit. I think that the broad array and varieties of organisms that are in naturally fermented foods, whether it be yogurt or kefir or sauerkraut or kombucha or a lot of different other things, I think that they really add something. So So I do recommend those things. Also, if someone's having a lot of tummy aches, I'm thinking about, are they eating something that's bothering them? And hands down, the biggest offender for things like gas, constipation, even diarrhea, is dairy. Mm-hmm. That's a big one for many, many kids.
Right.
And so I'm always kind of keeping that in the back of my mind. And usually there's a certain kind of dairy picture. You'll see the child who has the constipation. Maybe they were colicky as a baby. Then they might get ear infections. They have constipation. They might have a little asthma every once in a while, maybe seasonal allergies. Then they might start coming with any number of things, ADHD or seizures or what have you. So those are always going to jump into my mind as dairy kids. Mm-hmm. And so dairy, another big, big offender is gluten. And we're getting more, again, more and more data about how gluten not only affects the gut, whether it be celiac disease or gluten sensitivity, which is now its own entity and actually looks quite different in terms of diagnosis from celiac disease. The labs might look different. The gut might not have the same kind of pathology, but it still can be very significant. And we know that actually celiac and gluten sensitivity can really impact behavior as well. And there's a huge body of scientific evidence just about seizures and celiac disease or gluten, not to mention, you know, many other conditions. So dairy and gluten would be big ones, and of course there are other ones as well. But when someone's not feeling well, I'm thinking about healing their gut, which includes taking out offenders, as I just mentioned. It includes putting in probiotics and probiotic-rich foods. And I might also use certain things like teas or aloe juice, things which have really nice healing benefits in the gut so that we can kind of get the gut healthier. Licorice sometimes, not the candy, but in the form of a tea or in the form of DGL, mm-hmm. which is, can be chewable and really easy for kids to take, and it comes, you know, flavored. Right. So those are just some examples.
Yeah, so that's a great list of natural, gentle things to use to heal the GI tract. What about supplements? You know, I think it's a little reductionist to say, here's the vitamin or here's the herb, the phytonutrient that really boosts your IQ or helps you, like it's like a focus factor. There was actually a product that was marketed heavily called Focus Factor. It was like a one-stop shop to improved concentration and improved academic performance for kids. But it's not that simplistic. But are there some supplements that you favor for kids with these types of disorders?
Yes. I mean, you know, when it comes to something like, let's say, autism, it's such a complex condition that oftentimes there are many layers to what I'm going to recommend. First, we're going to do very significant work in the gut. And, of course, I didn't mention kind of the antimicrobials that I might use as well, which usually are going to be botanical. And I find that to be highly effective. I use whole plants. In my practice, I try my best to avoid using kind of extracts, meaning, you know, the one chemical compound being purified as if it's a pharmaceutical, because I think plants in their whole form actually have a very intelligent design that seems to be much more effective from everything I've seen.
So but, certain herbals like peppermint might have some antimicrobial effects? Or think you're thinking along those lines?
I mean, that's one, you know, olive leaf extract is one I like, garlic is one I like, ginger, you know, and there are many, many. I mean, you know, there are some that are very much stronger than that, you know, and I could use any number of them. And sometimes, you know, it's in very small amounts. Cat's claw, there's a whole variety of herbs which have not just, what I like about plants and what I think is so fascinating and effective about them is that they have hundreds if not thousands of different compounds in them, and they all work together in these synergistic ways to have certain effects in the body. So So whenever you're giving something for one issue, that plant is working in a lot of different ways at that time. It's not just doing the one thing you think you're trying to do, but it's supporting other systems as well. And so, you know, I like to say the side effects of plants, this is not, you know, 100% true. Obviously, anything can cause negative side effects as well, particularly in sensitive kids. But, you know, the side effects of plants are usually going to have positive effects, not negative effects. So I really do like to use those quite extensively in my practice.
Now, there's a big buzz in the autism community, also in the adult medicine community, about this new concept of MTHFR, methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase, genetic polymorphisms or SNPs or changes in the genetic code that make some kids and adults require more of certain functional B vitamins, but it's complicated because it's not just a matter of giving them one or another thing. Can you talk to us about that issue? Does it play a role in your treatment?
Sure. You know, the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase enzyme has become very popular and kind of a big focus point as part of a methylation the methylation process in our bodies. And part of the reason for that is that it's become easy to test for because it's important in cardiovascular health and other things. So somehow it's gotten covered by insurance, and so it's very, very easy to get now. And I think it's important, and I think that the topic of methylation is important, but I think there are many, many methylation enzymes. So this is not like the whole picture. But with that said, you know, the way I explain it to my patients is that methyl groups, which is a carbon and three hydrogens, are like a currency in the body. And they have to be attached to things or taken off of things to activate them or to deactivate them, whether it be, you know, neurotransmitters, enzymes, or other things. It's also important for detoxification. That's part of how we inactivate toxins, among, again, many others. And it certainly is very important in neurological health. So when someone has this mutation, and there are many different kinds of mutations that you can have, some are less significant and some are very significant, we find that giving B vitamins, and usually in a whole complex, not just one or the other, can be very helpful at supporting that system. And I've had patients with those mutations who were very depressed, for instance, or had a very hard time concentrating or other things, and we start them on a really good quality B complex with good bioavailable Bs, as well as looking at food and diet.
That would be methylfolate and methyl cobalamin, as opposed to the standard folic acid and cyanocobalamin you might find in cheaper B complex vitamins, right?
Right. So cyano I would avoid, but I actually like supplements that include both methyl and adenosyl cobalamin because those are both actually required.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly methyl, yes, and methyl tetrahydrofolate, MTHF. Sometimes we'll also see folinic. So those are sort of the more bioavailable forms. And the same goes for B6 and B2, that there are more bioavailable forms, and it's important. For me, I'm very picky about the supplements that I recommend, because if I'm giving something like that, I treat it as if it's a pharmaceutical, in the sense that it's synthetic, and so it's something that, you know, we have total control over how it's made, and we need to really understand what's in it and how it might affect us as best we can.
It's complicated. Do you want to say anything about the role of vitamin D? Because that's a vitamin that certainly is in vogue these days for adults, and does it play a role in children's health problems?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we don't yet totally understand how complex the whole vitamin D role is, and it's funny because I remember when I used to be in kind of a mainstream practice years ago, and I was testing for vitamin D, I was considered a total renegade, and it was like the pediatricians were shunned me because of the vitamin D, and actually one doctor in the hospital complained that I was checking people's vitamin D.
Wow, you got into trouble for checking for vitamin D.
Then, you know, it was funny because 3 or 4 years later, everyone's checking for vitamin D. Everybody's giving vitamin D, and it's, you know, kind of the pendulum has swung in the other direction. So I don't know You know what I'm interested in, actually, is so there's a lot of people now with very low vitamin D, and part of it is I think they're not out in the sun, and part of it is that there's something about our bodies that doesn't seem to, we seem to have difficulty binding vitamin D, mm-hmm. because there are people who require vast amounts. Yes. They may have a mutation in their binding receptor, but there may be other reasons that we don't understand, toxins that may interfere others. But with that said, vitamin D obviously is important in, you know, laying bone, and has to do with calcium, and we need magnesium and phosphate and zinc and other things for that. But in addition to that, it's a gene transcription factor and is important for immune health and other things, and we find that, you know, it may be very connected or somehow connected in the whole autism web as well. So I do recommend keeping an eye on that.
And certainly if you have a kid who's chronically sick, coming down with frequent colds and infections, and often adding some vitamin D can actually break that cycle of immune insufficiency.
It certainly plays a role.
Yeah. To switch gears slightly, because we're nearing the end of our podcast, but you did something very interesting in the past. You started something called the Mitzvah Meat and Mindful Meat Co-op. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I was starting out in neurology practice and a private practice, and, you know, the very beginning of that was, I mean, probably for a few weeks, but it was, I felt like I had a little time, and I was very interested in how food affected the brain, and also how, you know, food acts when we're eating animals in particular, that, you know, we're not thinking about where they're coming from, what they're eating, and so that affects them nutritionally for us, because we're not just what we eat, but we're what we eat.
Yes.
So, you know, we need to really think about that, and I wanted to help people become more mindful of that, and since this was not very available at the time, I worked on creating this co-op, which actually got quite a lot of attention in the New York Times Magazine and NPR and other things, because people were so excited and interested. And it was really a very interesting experience. I actually went to slaughterhouses. I visited farms. I got the whole experience and really learned quite a lot about food and farming and what growers and producers have to deal with. So now there are a lot of companies that offer this, which I'm happy to say, because I did not want to spend all my time as a meat purveyor. But
right. That could have been a second career. And maybe these days, with the way medicine is going, a more lucrative career. But nonetheless, you chose the path of medicine and service to the community. This mindful meat and or mitzvah meat project, is this still extant? Is, because, you know, and I've had this with my kosher patients, you know, it's hard enough finding kosher sources of meat, but then to find kosher organic, kosher grass-fed, you know, that's all these, it's layering on all sorts of additional requirements in the growing and the processing of the meat. So it's just tough enough finding just the grass-fed. Is this still a resource for patients who are following a kosher diet?
Well, not this particular project, but there are several businesses out there that are working on these kinds of issues, and I think that there will be more and more of that as well, because, you know, part of what I encourage my patients to do and people in my community is to vote with their food dollars and talk to farmers and talk to the local stores where they buy their food, and I think when the demand is there, then the food will be there too.
Well, great. That's wonderful, because you're working on both fronts, on the community action level as well as treating patients individually. So what's our intelligent medicine call to action here? Could you describe your practice? Do you have a website?
I do. I have a website, which is actually currently under construction, but soon will be unveiled, which is Brain Mending. That is a place that's going to be not just for information about my practice, but also for other information, resources about food and other things, and discussion groups. And I have a book that's coming out in the summer of 2015 with Simon and Schuster.
Great. Atria. Well, you'll have to revisit us when the book comes out. Do you have a working title for the book?
The working title right now is Brain Mending.
Nice, nice.
So we shall see. We shall see.
I think you coined a term there. I think that could really take off. So congratulations. And for our listening audience, your practice is located in Riverdale, New York. Is that correct?
That's right. Right outside of Manhattan.
Okay, great. So the website brainmending.com gives you all the details. And as a dual alum of Columbia College, Albert Einstein College of Medicine as well, I feel you're a kindred spirit embarking on a career in the field of complementary and alternative medicine, representing a new generation of doctors who are here to carry forth this, I think, very, very promising avenue for getting patients well. And applying it to kids, I think, is very important because there's a dearth of pediatricians doing this kind of medicine.
That's absolutely true. I agree with you. And I'm very happy that you're out there also educating people this way.
Well, thank you very much. All right. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Maya Shetreat Klein. I'll spell it once again, S-H-E-T-R-E-A-T. Shetreat. The way you can remember that is that she probably should have been a gynecologist. Shetreat. Dash Klein, K-L-E-I-N. Thank you very much, Dr. Shetreat Klein, for joining us on today's edition of Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Until the next time, thanks for joining us.